from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in Paris with the closing of an iconic bookstore. What began in 1886 as a bookstall on the banks of the Seine has grown into a popular French chain called... Oh man, I was told there'd be no French pronunciation. My French is so bad. Gilbert Jean, how's that? Its world-renowned location in Paris's Latin Quarter will close its doors this month after 50 years due to challenges caused by the coronavirus pandemic. As reported by The Guardian, sales at that particular store are down 60% during the pandemic, and the owner of the building has decided to sell it. It's one of many businesses in that area that, without the traffic of students or tourists, cannot survive. But The Guardian also explains that the company was slow to react to trends in the industry and the impact of Amazon and other online retailers. Gilbert Jean is not alone here. Some reports say the pandemic has led to a significant increase in online sales, and there are varying reports about the sales of books in general. It's kind of hard to get a clear read on it, but it's certain across the board that many brick-and-mortar bookstores have closed. We know that. Publishers Weekly keeps a running list of those closures and other industry struggles, including event cancellations and more. That has led to the publishing industry pushing back release dates and considering how to adapt amid the pandemic. It's also leading publishers to rethink their strategies, especially digital strategies, for the future. This hour we opened with a question at the top of this hour. We asked you, when's the last time you read a book for pleasure? The stats in this country are not very promising for authors, for booksellers, for publishers as we look at the future. But maybe the last 12 months have at least given us a sense to reconnect with the written word. Maybe I'm being optimistic, but I'd like to think that's true. And this hour, we're talking about the state of the publishing industry, book sales and bookstores, and what to expect. Our guests include Carlo DeVito, a prolific author, a longtime publishing industry executive, and by way of full disclosure, a man who once made a foolish decision to publish my book. Carlo, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be here. Thank you.
That was another lifetime anyway. Allison Myers, Executive Director of Writers and Books in Rochester, back on the program. Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
And Christy Gibson is the owner of Magpie Bookshop, a smaller seller. Christy, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me today.
I'm going to ask all three of you what the last 12 months have been like, and I will ask our listeners if they want to join the conversation by letting me know what sort of if the last 12 months have impacted your habits, if it's revived your book reading, if you are finally peeling books off the shelves that you bought but never read, are you buying new books, and if you are you connecting with your small local bookseller, or are you going online to do it? And that's sort of a... You know, those things are sort of at odds with each other. Carlo DeVito, how do you see the landscape of publishing, a year into this pandemic?
Oh, well, it's certainly changed. In the beginning, when everything was closed down, as you said earlier, a lot of publishers put off putting out their books, pushed them back, very much like the same way the movie industry did, and then finally had to adapt to a new way of doing business and had to learn how to pivot quickly. But it cost them in a number of different ways. There are a lot of people who don't have jobs now that had jobs a year and a half ago. It's been different. It's been difficult. And a lot of it has happened online. But there are rumors that the retail sales are rebounding. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, and Carlo, Jim Milliot of Publishers Weekly said the delays in releasing books happened really at the front end of this pandemic when there was a panic about, that the industry thought we're going to see widespread closures, tours are not going to happen, book tours for authors. They wondered how you're going to get new books into stores at all, let alone get books to Amazon. And by late May of last year, Publishers Weekly reported roughly 800 change of dates here. So when you were sort of hearing about that, and you're always working on a book yourself, I mean, you've probably always have multiple projects going. What is the impact on authors when there is that kind of delay? And frankly, did it impact writers like yourself, Carlo?
Yes and no. I mean, it certainly affected the sort of chain. I mean, things in the beginning, things were delayed. So, and that certainly talks about revenue streams, right? I mean, let's be honest, these are businesses, and if you're not shipping books, you're not getting paid, and you're not paying the people that work for you, whether it's freelancers or printers or staff. So there are a lot of – there's a huge impact on the other side. So those are some of the things you have to deal with. As an editor, yeah, I had one project that got delayed. It means I'm not getting another check for a little while. And so there was that sort of a crashing train. You know, the front part's really ugly, and then the back, it all starts to pile up as it goes along.
Hmm. Well, let's get the sense for what's going on in different locations and in Magpie Bookshop. Christy, why don't you give us a sense for how big a bookshop and what the last 12 months have been like for you?
Okay. My bookshop is in the town of Catskill, New York. So I'm right sort of in the middle of the Hudson Valley, and I'm an all used bookshop. I have about between 10 and 15,000 books in my shop at any time, and I don't sell online. So I'm 100% reliant off of foot traffic. But because of where I'm situated in the Hudson Valley, we've had a tremendous number of people move into the area, mostly from New York City over the last 12 months. So my shop has actually had the busiest year I've ever had this past year.
Wow. And what are your
huge number of people have moved up here?
Wow. What are your colleagues in other stores, maybe and even in other towns and locations, saying?
So there's actually... We're really fortunate in this area. This part of the Hudson Valley, there's actually 26 bookstores within about an hour and a half range of here. We're really heavy on bookstores, and they're almost evenly divided between secondhand bookstores and shops that sell new books. And all the ones I've spoken to have said they're also having very busy years this year.
How do you, Christy, deal with the online retailers in a normal year, let alone in a pandemic, when people feel like that they should stay home and only order online?
It's interesting. I think I just have a slightly different customer base. I really have a shop for browsing. If somebody knows exactly what they're looking for, then they're usually not going to try to hit 10 or 15 used bookshops trying to randomly find it. They're probably going to go online and find the one copy that's still out there. My kind of customer really wants to browse. They're not sure what they're looking for. So the hard part for me was being closed for 3 months during the shutdown because there was really no way for people to browse. But as soon as I reopened in mid-June, there was a flood of people. I mean, my main concern over the entirety of the pandemic has just been really keeping the shop safe. But I've actually been really fortunate. You know, the vast majority of people are really good about wearing masks and being careful and socially distancing. I really haven't had any problems. Hmm.
Allison Myers, Executive Director of Writers and Books in Rochester. How much did the pandemic impact what you planned to do in 2020? And how are things going now?
Yeah, it's really been such an interesting period for everybody in the literary industry and for all organizations along the entire publishing chain. In our public programming, we responded quickly and pivoted to a virtual platform. And for our adult programs, primarily comprising what we call visiting authors readings, and those are akin to what would have been book releases in the old days in person, whereby authors come, they read for about 20 minutes and then engage in conversation and Q&A for 20 minutes. And our other primary adult program is workshops, and those are interactive. So initially, I think for us, the great advantage to going to the virtual platform has been an opportunity to access authors from all across the country and even authors from Europe and England who are eager to get out to as many readers as possible during a time when they can't physically move around and conduct a book tour. So that's actually been a wonderful advantage for us. And our audience base has diversified and increased because of that. We also partnered with BOA Editions, the poetry small press publisher here in Rochester, to develop a virtual series called Tuesdays with BOA Editions. and that's been very successful as well as we cross-promote across our audiences. There is, on the other hand, a huge competition for that virtual space. So, for example, publishers are doing more in that space than they normally would have. In other words, they're kind of taking up some of the retailing function there and doing their own, running their own authors tours. Other publishers, though, have been great in partnering with bookstores and organizations. It's kind of a mixed bag. I'm in very close touch to the small press publishing industry, and I know that for some of the nonprofits, for instance, Nightboat Books, which is a very busy small press publisher. They put out about 18 new releases a year, which is a lot for small press. But their executive director has reported that they've actually done very well. Their donations are up and their sales are up, basically appealing to the philanthropic instincts of individuals who see the importance of keeping our literary landscape, you know, lively and diverse, and they're investing kind of in the cultural future of the nation as well as, you know, wanting to acquire really great books. Well, the other part...
Go ahead, Allison, go ahead.
I would just say that for our youth programs, we were really impacted primarily negatively because everybody knows the strain that this has put on households with children, the parents having to become teachers, huge Zoom fatigue, and our most popular and longest standing program for youth, which usually serves 600 kids K through 12 every summer in July and August, was impacted greatly. It operated at like 22% of its usual capacity on a Zoom platform. So that was the other side of the pendulum for us. And the other thing is that we do have an indie bookstore, Ampersand Books, and I feel we've done very well on a virtual platform. We were able to launch our virtual platform in April, and our sales are going up every month.
Well, listeners, coming up here, we'll take some of your feedback on how maybe your own habits have been impacted. But taking, you know, sort of that broader look at what's happening in publishing, I mentioned Gilbert Jeune at the start of the hour. By the way, Carlo, how's my French on that one?
That was very good. I was very impressed.
Yeah, you don't know.
For somebody from where, Rochester.
Yeah, exactly right. So the Guardian reports, though, by the way, that is one shop. But the first Gilbert Jeune bookshop opposite Notre Dame is staying put. And they're trying to find creative ways to survive. But we see other stores, Bayou City Books in Niceville, Florida, closed in January after 34 years in business. Grizzly Books and Serendipity Shop in Revelstoke, British Columbia, closed in January after 20 years in business for, you know, all of the reasons that you can imagine. And so I want to ask all of you about one thing that concerns me. When I look at the restaurant scene, we've talked about it on this program that if you look at Manhattan, we've seen a lot of independent one-off restaurants close or at least be suspended in their business in the last 12 months. We generally see the chains hanging in there. And some of the folks in restaurateurship have told us on this program that their concern is whether it's Manhattan, Rochester, anywhere, what we are going to see in restaurants are the interesting, the small, the independent, the local close, and the big chains stay. And if you look at publishing, my concern would be, if publishing houses are struggling, and they're going to keep on the big authors, the well-named authors, the ones that move books just by name recognition, but the really interesting projects that were new and in development might never get done now. Is that a realistic concern, Carlo, to compare it to the restaurant industry that way, or is that off base?
Well, I think it does go back to the small presses. I think that there's always been an issue in the big. In the big publishing companies about what's the lowest threshold you're really willing to take on in terms of a book project, how many copies will it sell? And, you know, places like, Random Penguin, et cetera, they have very high thresholds. I mean, if you're not going to sell 15 or 20,000 copies, they really can't afford to sell your book. That's really what it comes down to. That's a completely different dynamic that's independent of a pandemic or not. So that's always a threshold that they have to deal with. I think by now, publishers have to certainly be adhering to some very strict standards right now, because you do have some limitations. Although, again, because people are home, they have been reading more. You've seen Amazon's sales jump tremendously, but at what cost to some bookstores, mm-hmm. or places like Barnes and Noble, the brick and mortar. So that's changed in that respect. So if you're an author and you have a project, where do you bring it? It's a little tougher to get through some of the slipstreams right now than it might have been a year and a half ago, where somebody would be more willing to take a flyer on a smaller book.
Right, right. Allison Myers, certainly no judgment on what people read, and it takes all kinds, but I don't need a 50 Shades COVID edition. I like seeing the interesting stuff, and that's one of the things that Writers and Books does so well. Are you concerned that there could be an impact in this pandemic that starts to put the squeeze on the kinds of interesting projects that big and small publishers would normally engage in?
No, I'm actually not, because the small press industry has been in ascendant, actually, very steadily over the last, I'd say, almost decade. The proliferation of small presses, there's still every day a new small press begins. If you go to the website of Community of Literary Magazines and Presses, for instance, their membership is just, it's rather mind-boggling how many small presses specializing in different niches and primarily honoring marginalized voices that never will have a platform with the big five. These are not projects that typically would ever be, picked up by a Viking Penguin or Simon & Schuster. So I think, if anything, the pendulum will continue to swing in the other direction, primarily because most small presses are nonprofits, and the philanthropic ecology has responded pretty quickly and pretty generously to the literary arts in terms of COVID relief grants. Here in Rochester, many foundations have really just kind of jumped right into a new emphasis in terms of no longer saying we'll give you grants for specific programs. Let's see if we can give you money for general operating support. So, it's really kind of the world of big capitalism versus, another kind of business model. So it's a little bit of an apple and an orange. But I'm personally not concerned about the representation of interesting, important, and frequently marginalized literary voices.
Okay. Christy Gibson.
I agree.
Go ahead, Carl.
Presses are on the ascendant. I agree.
Okay. Christy Gibson, how do you see it?
From the consumer standpoint, I get a lot of people coming in looking for small press publications. A lot of people come in wanting things that are works in translation or stuff that's more unusual. And a lot of that stuff hits, the used market a little bit down the road. But there's definitely a demand for it. People are interested in reading a pretty wide variety of things.
Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI for calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Roy in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Roy.
Good afternoon. I wanted to say that, like any other global disaster, we just shake the rubble off and keep on reading. I turned to a chance to finish reading anything I could get by Philip Kerr on the Berlin Noir series. He kind of reminded, he did for Berlin what Chandler did to L.A. But he died before COVID really took off. Also, here in town, I see the little stores, Rick's Recycled, North, Greenwood, or Before Your Quiet Eyes, where the Just Poets are making their own mixture going online. Now they have people who come to their readings from India, England, Argentina, and elsewhere. Things seem to be continuing. We're still moving.
Yeah, yeah. I take the point, Roy, that reading is alive and well. And I think Allison, thank you for the phone call, Roy. I think Allison Myers was making, you know, a similar point there, that you have been able to connect with people in the online space in new ways. Are there certain things that will change permanently, Allison, based on what you've learned in the last 12 months at what you do at Writers and Books?
Yeah, I think it's generally acknowledged throughout the literary arts industry that our ecology will never ever rebound to where it was, how we look at space, how we look at hybridity. We, for instance, have thought more deeply about areas, different neighborhoods and communities we are not reaching, that we have never reached adequately by just kind of enclosing our programs in one physical location at 740 University Avenue, and are looking at partnerships. We're developing new partnerships with neighborhood libraries, for instance, thinking about the ways in which we can be in other spaces, both virtually and in person, and to curate programming in partnership with other community needs. I think for us, it's really expanded our sense of inclusion and our desire to learn more and interact more generatively with our surrounding community. We're hoping we will reopen our doors at 740 University Avenue in September and look forward to actually being in person with so many members of our community. But we now have an expanded sense of our community through virtual space. So we absolutely plan on retaining many of our, our online programs and events. It's been exciting, actually, coming in contact mm-hmm. with people in our our world, people who love to read, love to write. I don't see it ever being the same.
Christy Gibson, I know your time's a little limited here, so let me just ask you, are things opening up a little bit? Are things a little bit more comfortable now that we're a year in, some of the restrictions have loosened, and you can see more people?
I think most of us around here are still being pretty careful in terms of asking people to wear masks and limiting the number of people inside. But in the used book industry, at least, so many of us don't really have a huge online presence, at least the older shops. So we all reopened back in mid-June with regular operations, except with restrictions, obviously, in terms of masks and occupancy. And it's been going very smoothly. I must say, though, bookstore customers are some of the most thoughtful people on earth. Mm. So it's easier for us than it is for restaurants, I think, and for some other places, just because our customers are so understanding. You know, they really are willing to wear masks. They're willing to wait if they need to, if there's too many people in the shop. So.
And before I kick it over,
been very fortunate.
Before I kick it over to Carla, since you've got to run, anything you want to leave our listeners with as they think about their book buying habits, Christy?
Oh, it's certainly the only reason why we're alive, especially the used book industry down here, is because people come and shop from small businesses. I think Independent Bookstore Day and things like the Hudson Valley Book Trail have really helped expand people's awareness of just how important it is to actually come and shop at these smaller businesses and at least try finding it at us first before they go on to a bigger place like Amazon.
Grateful for your time, and you and your colleagues across New York State, really across this country, are I love what you do. I'm so glad that you're part of these communities. Christy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christy Gibson's the owner of Magpie Bookshop, and really she's the voice of so many small booksellers that we have so much love for. After this, our only break, I'm going to ask Carlo and Allison. Carlo DeVito is an author and longtime publishing industry executive, a guy who knows just about everybody in the industry, it seems. Allison Myers, executive director of Writers and Books in Rochester. And on the other side, we're going to talk about habits. We talked movie habits recently. And one of the concerns that, you know, everyone who is involved with brick and mortar movie theaters have is that we're all going to stay on streaming platforms forever. Every time we want to watch a movie, we're going to decide to go on Netflix or Hulu or somewhere else, and we're not going to go out. Now, obviously, that's not going to be everybody. But the concern is that enough of that habit change will be permanent, that it will be hard for some to recover. Well, what about reading? Is it too hopeful that I'm thinking, well, maybe we are reading more? I'm seeing your emails. We'll read your emails in a moment. Maybe the last 12 months have gotten more of us to get back into a regular routine of reading, reading for pleasure, reading because we want to, reading because we're making time for it. And will that help the industry? The other side of that coin is whether kids are doing it. Kids, young adults, and we know their reading habits are very different than their parents. And what do we do with that? So a lot of things to try to solve and puzzle out. We'll take more of your phone calls and feedback as we talk the future of the publishing industry, how it's been impacted by the pandemic, and where it goes next here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Wall Street Journal reports that the Cuomo administration actively covered up nursing home deaths in the pandemic, especially in the early months. Why? We welcome Wall Street Journal reporter Jimmy Vielkind to explain what we know so far. We're also talking to advocates for reform who've been calling for changes in nursing home regulations since long before the pandemic. Where do we go next? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kate emails the program to say that, Evan, my goal is to read 100 books each year. I do buy from Amazon, also the Barnes & Noble store near me, and I go to the library. I don't think there's a local bookstore near me, so this show is interesting. Well, Kate, there's a local bookstore. There's nothing wrong with Barnes & Noble. There's nothing wrong with anybody who is in business anywhere, but I bet you can find it if you do some Googling. There's probably a little bit more than you think. Joel says, I'm reading way more in the last year, buying more books than I have in 15 or more years. So the question, Carlo, that comes out of this for me is sort of twofold. Number one, do you, just anecdotally, do you think people are reading more in the last 12 months? And if they are, might that engender a change in habits somewhat permanently? Will that be a boon for the publishing industry? And then conversely, what in the world do we do with young adults and teenagers who simply read fewer books than previous generations? Do you worry about that? So, Carlo, I'll start with you.
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah. I mean, you got kids, you know.
I know. Actually, my son is a really good barometer of all this. He is a security officer at one of the largest hospitals in the country out in the Midwest. And when he's not working, he's at home, and he has read voraciously in this period. And he's discovered new authors like Stephen Ambrose and Cornelius Ryan. So he's absolutely been thrilled with the opportunity to reconnect with books. Will he continue to read once the pandemic is over? I'm not sure. I mean, he's always been a pretty good reader. He's obviously been a voracious one recently. But once it opens up a little, I think he'll probably go back to fishing a little more than he has in recent months. So it's an interesting question. I certainly think that there'll be a portion of people who've reconnected with books and may not read as much as they have over the last 12, 14 months. But I think there will be a slight continuance of that. I think other people will go back to very busy lives and probably not read as much. But I think that there's a good number of people who have actually reconnected in that period. So that I tend to be more hopeful than not.
Okay. Allison Myers, how do you see that?
Well, it's interesting. Before COVID, going back several years now, the National Endowment for the Arts has been reporting that the reading of literary texts has been climbing, increasing and growing. And I'll have to say, when I was living and working in New York City not that long ago, I was always inspired and impressed by seeing lots of children with paperback books in their hands, you know, some of the Judy Blume books and some others newer, not necessarily the classics. I think there's more reading going on than that's in the popular imagination. I think that's always been the case. I don't think it's possible to really kind of pull that, but I do think that there has been a kind of psychological, social sea change during COVID where people have perhaps become more contemplative, more self-observing, looking at their own habits, reevaluating their values. And I think some of the, for instance, the book buying trends have possibly or may begin to shift as some literary consumers think about, it does matter where I spend my dollar, whether I want to invest in a local bookstore like Magpie or Ampersand Books at Writers and Books. Just, I think, an increased consciousness. And my hope, not necessarily my expectation, is that it won't just rebound to reflexive things. Well, I need the instant gratification of getting my Amazon book, you know, zoomed over to me in 2 days. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's see what happens in using libraries, too. I mean, our libraries are just so important to us. And I know they've really worked hard to make books available during the times of restrictions with drop-offs and pickups. So, you know, I think it's kind of a wait and see. This is such an unprecedented historical moment.
Yeah, and I take Allison's point that younger adults are probably reading more than maybe some people even give them credit for. I don't want anyone listening to say, well, Evan Dawson says, you know, that young adults don't read books. I mean, I know that it does happen. But younger adults are used to much wider options when it comes to media. And reading is sometimes longer form articles, reading online. I mean, I don't discount reading, you know, unless it's a book. I mean, reading is reading. It's just that habits are certainly changing with the technology. That's all I'm saying. I'm certainly not maligning anybody, though I do love books. No. I do love books, and I miss that. So, Carla,
digital space requires reading, but at the same time, it's not sitting down with a longer piece, whether it's a novella or even if for a child a book, and having them sit down and go through it, as opposed to the magical stimulation of the digital space.
Yeah, and so what do you do, Carlo, with that? I mean, is this on schools? If we decide, and I don't know who we are, the decision makers of society decide that reading books is good and that it's important to try to preserve that habit, and we look at kids who are becoming adults, is a lot of it in schools or a lot of it on us, Carlo?
I have to say that I don't think you can ask your school teacher to parent your child like that. I think that reading starts in the home, and we were always very cognizant of, you know, there's a time and place for digital play or television, whatever that electronic distraction is, and there's a time for turning that off and reading. And I think especially in our case, I think it's a follow by example kind of thing. I think our kids were influenced by the fact that both my wife and I were avid readers. Mm-hmm. I tended to read more for research and whatever project I have to be working on at the time. But she was a much more avid reader in terms of just pure enjoyment. But our house was always filled with books, and I think that carried over. So I think we were fortunate in that way, but it was also, I think, a lead by example. Very hard to get kids to focus on books if that's not part of the lifestyle that they grow up in.
I'm going to read a couple more emails in a moment here, I'll ask listeners, what are you reading? I'm someone who, once in a while, I'll see a review or a book mention or an NPR interview, and I'll think, I really want that, but I often don't read if it's not for the show, because there's so much reading that's required for the show. Now, I have the advantage of, you know, if I want a book on the show or if I want to read a book, I just ask the author to come on, which is why Carlos been on in the past. I said, oh, Miss Lee's Rose Garden, I want to read that. I guess we're going to do a show on that. So that is a massive privilege. I grant that. But there were two books on my shelf that I picked up again for the first time in years this year. One of them was A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman.
I
remember.
You know, it's about our tumultuous 14th century, especially because of a plague. So I don't know if there was a reason that I was drawn back to that. I also picked up a book called Evening's Empire, which is a history of the night in Europe. And it is about the ways that our habits, pre-technology especially, you know, changed and different traditions of what people did in the overnight hours. It wasn't just sleep and wake up to your cell phone alarm and then, you know, and go to work. So those were two books maybe impacted by, maybe the pandemic like put those right at the top of my brain. So I picked those back up. But I do think, Allison, I'm probably sounding a little bit fuddy-duddy-ish, Allison, but I love the feeling of buying a book and the excitement of what's to come when you hold it. And I don't know if that tradition is, I want that tradition to live on in perpetuity, and maybe I'm being too cynical or concerned that it's going to go away.
It's not going away. It's not going
I'm glad anywhere. To hear that.
Books are an artifact as well as being an experience, right? There's nothing that supplants holding that thing in your hand, feeling the texture, the heft of the book, the quality of the paper, the smell of the ink, you know, the physical act of literally turning a page, right? Nothing replaces that and nothing ever will. I remember having an argument with I used to own a bookstore, and a bookstore customer, and this goes back 25 years. Oh, we're all going to be reading off chips, you know. and I said, well, that wouldn't fit my habits at all. And I bet in a Broadway show that wouldn't come to pass. I have never collected on it. But if you take, for instance, a book that won the Pulitzer, a book of poems by Tyenda Jeff, probably 3-4 maybe years ago, called Olio. And this was published by a small press that formatted the book according to the author's specifications, which includes taking a middle section, accordion-like, out of the middle of the book. You can pull that all the way out, including perforations where the author wanted people to tear the books out and build a pyramid of a three-sided sonnet. so I think that the sheer love of everything that means book to people who have grown up in the tradition of holding books in their hands, and the excitement of, you know, when the package comes in the mail, opening it up, and the actual thing itself. That is so privileged by small presses. There are so many gorgeous illustrations, you know, for book covers, the thoughtful typesetting. It's just, you know, it's exciting, it's wonderful, and I think the way it connects with the human psyche means it's here to stay.
Well, on that note,
I agree.
On that note, optimistic note that we all needed, here's Sally in Rochester on the phone to add to that. Go ahead, Sally.
Hi, Evan and guests. I am reading more. I am buying more. I profess to loving books lifelong. I'm now in my 70s. I'm browsing more. Sometimes I browse online, but my favorite browsing, my favorite of all times, is a bookstore locally that was mentioned earlier, Before Your Quiet Eyes. It's on Monroe Avenue. It's quirky. Mm-hmm. Like you want a bookstore to be. It's got nooks and crannies. It's got a devoted following, so I can connect with people, whether online or maybe one at a time, during the events and open hours with limitations, with safe limitations that Ken Kelbaugh has. So just thank you to that man in particular for putting together a collection that is amazing and giving us a garden to enjoy books in. My home has been taken over by books, and I can swear to you honestly, there are more than 20,000 books in my home.
Oh, man. And
I don't care. I don't care. When I go, if I haven't cleaned out this house myself with help from my friends, I know that God will send a book lover.
There you go.
What a fabulous phone. Sally, thank you for that. 20,000 books in the home. That is all kinds of goals for all of us. I think that is beautiful. I find myself routinely asking myself, should I pare down, you know, every few years or so, I go, you know, should I keep these books? Will I revisit them? Do I want to remember that I read them? I mean, Allison, how many books do you keep out of the books that you read? Because for me, it's not a huge percentage, but it's not 20,000 like Sally.
Yeah, I would say I probably keep 20% now in my dotage. when I was a kid, I just collected and collected and collected. And through the years, through many relocations, I've divested myself of whole libraries, you know, giving them away or, you know, actually giving them away. And I really now very stringently say, is this a book I want to go back to? The books that I don't rotate out are my books of poetry. I always go back to my shelves. I can't tell you how many times I've reread particular poets.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like, for instance, you read the Through a Distant Mirror, right? So that is a book you want to keep on your shelf, like Working by Studs Terkel. Why? Because you want to lend it out to a young person to read and return, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. You know, you just make those kinds of very personal decisions as you go.
Carlo DeVito, what about you? I mean, my sort of habits are I will keep a book if I want to, if I found an important book, even if I know I won't read it again, if I found it truly delightful that I might loan out, as Allison says, or if it's something I want to return to. I mean, there's my favorite essayist is the late David Rakoff, and his books are on my shelf. And, you know, every few years or so, I will read a few and happily find out that he still surprises me, even though I've already read the essays. What about you, Carlo?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, there are ones that are keepers and there are ones that are not. I moved recently and had to get rid of quite a number of books, which was incredibly painful.
It's like surgery, man.
it's like surgery. It's so many choices as you go through. It's really quite awful. But there is the beauty of going back to something, whether I'm using it for research or whether I'm doing it for pleasure. There are certain books that you are drawn back to. I'm very, very fortunate enough that I got as a gift a first edition of F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby. And I can't tell you how many times I've dipped back into that throughout it. And I agree, you never throw out a poetry book. I don't care. There are rules in life, and you never throw out a poetry book. So that goes
rules,
along
Carla.
With it.
Great rules,
on the other
Carla,
hand, I do research. I do a lot of research. And when that project is over, unless I'm going to stay in that same genre, I'll let mm-hmm. some of those go. I mean, I keep all the Twain and the Dickens. There's no way I'm letting any of that go. But some of the other stuff, you just have to say, look, that project is over, and I need to move on, mm-hmm. and I need the book space back because I'm going to be working on another project, and I need the book space.
Indeed. Let me welcome a couple other phone calls while we still have some time. Steve in Brighton next. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Evan, how you doing?
Good, sir.
I have to say I'm struggling with thinning out my collection of trade, building trade books.
Oh, yes.
And I've found people that I don't sell them. They've become not so valuable, but they're valuable to me, and I have found people to send them to. But I write how-to books, okay? It's not literature, but I have to say during COVID, the sales exploded on me. I'm just shocked by it, and I don't know what to attribute people are home with nothing to do and they're looking at their house. I don't know, but I did want to point that out.
The industry exploded. You are absolutely right, sir. The industry exploded. Home Depot and Lowe's had massive improvements in their sales, and people couldn't wait to rip apart, put them in that re-outfit their bathroom, redo their deck, whatever. And if you're in the if you're in the how-to, you probably had a very good year, so.
I did have a good year, and I should point out that every time I do one of these, the question is, should we do an e-book or a print book? And I poll people, and it's always, oh, no, no. If you want that in your lap, okay?
Absolutely.
You got to have it in print, yeah. So anyway, I just thought I'd point that out, guys.
Well,
I enjoyed the show.
Always appreciate the phone call, Steve. Thank you. That is, as listeners may know, Steve is extremely experienced and one of the really, really outstanding trades folks in our region. I did not know about his authorship, though. Go ahead, Carlo.
What I was going to say is that there are certain books that, in our experience on the publishing side, did not translate to the Kindle or the Nook or any of those electronic devices. cookbooks really didn't make a jump to that platform. We certainly put a lot of books in those platforms. They really didn't move in any substantial way. How-to books were another genre that people wanted to have a physical copy in their hands. It was, for whatever reason, there were certain categories that did not make the jump to the digital space. And those two categories were two of the really big ones.
That is, but I guess that's not a surprise, especially on the cookbook side of things. You want to sort of be holding something that you can almost tactically, in a tactile sense, feel and flip through, especially if you're literally working in real time on it. You don't want to be, at least that's how I would think of it.
I mean, those were illustrated books, right? So
sure.
Anything with illustration, I mean, there might have been a few one-color books like How to Cook Everything, Joy of Cooking, but more often than not, we saw, as both a former Barnes & Noble employee and a publishing person, we saw no real uptick and on the digital space with cookbooks, especially illustrated cookbooks.
Yeah, very interesting. Alan in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Alan.
Hi, Evan. Nice to hear the program. I wanted to chime in on the other side of the people in love with physical books, which I have a lot of. I do a lot of reading, both for business and pleasure, and I'm much more happy with my Kindle source, particularly for business books, because of the highlighting feature and the fact that it puts it all in a notebook for easy reference is really, really handy.
Alan, you wear a bow tie, and you're not an old-school book fan. You're a new-school fan. Come on, man.
Hey, I'm a new guy, new age.
I love that. So it's more there's real utility, it sounds like, in the technology for you there, Alan.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And okay. Well, I'll always appreciate it. By the way, Alan.
Plus, my phone fits on my exercise bike. So
there you go.
All right, Alan. I'm getting a vaccine tomorrow, so I'm going to buy you coffee soon.
All right, love it.
Okay, so send me a note separately. So briefly here, before we lose the hour, I want to ask a couple quick questions from listeners, and then I want to ask our guest to weigh in on a couple thoughts here before we're gone here. Kathy says, I've been ordering from bookshop.org all pandemic. Do your guests have any knowledge or thoughts on that organization? I don't. Allison, do you?
My bookstore coordinator would be more knowledgeable. Clara would be on this, but I believe it's the centralizing website that then shows you a bookstore near you. We've received many, 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 many orders through that centralization. That's the real. I mean, the American Booksellers Association has grown and changed so massively since I was a bookseller many years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, the services that they provide and the real service to the overall field. I can't tell you how many emails filled with guidance and pointing booksellers toward COVID relief and just phenomenal organization. And I think bookshop.org, I don't know if it's affiliated with ABA, but I do believe it's another one of these centralizing, sites that benefits the independent bookstore.
Gotcha. 20 seconds, Carlo, on that one. Anything you want to add on bookshop.org?
No, I think she said it all. I think she was very concise on that.
Okay. Last couple quick points here. Listeners are calling out their favorite small stores like Liftbridge and Brockport. There's so many, and we love what they do for our communities, and we want you to stay. And if you know a small bookseller, if you know a small shop, we'd love to just hear how they're doing. If they want to send a separate email, just hope that they're hanging in there as best they can. About 40 seconds apiece, Carlo. I'll start with you. What's the next challenge for the publishing industry, and how concerned are you about the future of the industry?
Oh, I think the industry has pivoted pretty decently overall. I think that they'll be anxious to get back to bookselling in brick and mortar in a more meaningful way. I think that, but there are some changes that my co-panelist has already mentioned. Though. I mean, with the advent of using the digital space, I think some of the landscape has changed forever. Although there's nothing quite as exciting as going to a book, a reading, or a Q&A with an author and getting to interact.
Yep.
There's nothing ever going to replace that. And I'm still a little kid. I knew the Writers Workshop did a digital piece with William Kennedy. They did another one with Richard Russo. And I used to actually go to those, and really, I was like a 5-year-old, just like anybody else, happy to sit there and listen.
I'm with you there, man.
I think that part, I think we'll get back to that as soon as we possibly can. I don't think that part, I think that part of it is still one of the most exciting, and I agree, opening up a package that has a book in it is always an exciting moment. It's like Christmas.
All right, Allison Myers, if you can do it in 30 seconds or less, what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to speak to the challenge that I see of different elements of the publishing chain operating a little bit in silos. I would like to see more cooperation and coordination among authors, agents, editors, publishers, bookstores, literary organizations that have very small budgets. How can we work as a consortium to make sure that the literary arts are alive and well?
Well, I'm grateful for your time, Allison Myers, Executive Director of Writers and Books, and we can't wait to see you. I know we're seeing you online. We'll see you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carlo DeVito, author and longtime publishing industry executive. Always good, my friend. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And more connections coming up in a moment.